Today is Friday the 13th of November. It's 2020. This is part 5 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Carl. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well.
Good, good, good. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You certainly may.
Thank you. Carl, at the end of part 4, you were talking about working in interpretation in the spring and summer of 1981, and some of the words you could use that were red flags, and you could get around those words with, as long as you didn't mention them, and talked about the slide projectors. And I also wondered about your dress, your uniform. Did anybody, want to make sure your uniform was like exact and looked really good? And just curious about that.
It was very much a thing. We had working the desk there at Grand Canyon, everybody coming and going from the post office would walk right by the information desk when they were going back to the offices there. The acting superintendent, who was the chief ranger and whose name I have forgotten, would come back from the post office, and he'd look us over, and if he saw something he didn't like a shirt pocket unbuttoned or whatever, why, he wouldn't tell us. He would stop by Jack O'Brien's office, the chief of interp, and tell him, and then Jack would have to come out and tell us to button our pockets or whatever. But in those days, uniforms were a much bigger deal than they were later on in my career. There was a specific day that we changed from summer to winter uniform, and it was based partly on the calendar and partly on the weather forecast. But one day everybody in the park was supposed to wear their summer uniforms, and then the next day everybody was supposed to be in their winter uniforms, and we just stayed that way until we changed back in the spring. And by that time, I guess the good part was that women's uniforms were we were getting past the little stewardess outfits that women had to wear in the early days.
Where did you first see those uniforms?
My first summer in the way back in 1974 at Petrified Forest, the women had the little tan, we called them A-frames, but I think that they were technically A-line dresses with the little pillbox cap and all that. And they did have a name tag and a badge, but it was that. And there was one ranger that I worked with. Her first name was Gretchen. I can't remember her last name. But we were working the entrance station there at Petrified Forest, and I was working the outbound window, and she was working the inbound window. And so somebody drove up, and she sold them their permit, got them all fixed up to go into the park. And then when she was done, the guy is looking straight at me and says, "And now I have a question for the ranger." And Gretchen jumps right in front of him and says, "Yes."
Good for her.
So she eventually got fed up with wearing that, and got her, I think, boyfriend at the time. But anyway, got a hold of a men's uniform that she could alter so that she could wear the green and gray when she was working.
Did anybody say anything when she did that?
No. Petrified Forest was maybe a small enough park that that kind of stuff you could kind of get away with. And she was the kind of person who, she was like, "No, if I'm going to be a ranger, I'm going to look like a ranger."
Good for her.
And so it was a case of course, it was my first summer, and I didn't know how the system worked entirely.
Okay.
But kind of a combination of I think she stood up for herself, and the people above her either saw the light or didn't think it was worth the fight.
Okay.
But yeah, it was. And of course, in those days, the uniforms were there wasn't a variety of stuff that we have today, so we just had to kind of make do with what was ever in the uniform catalog. The other thing that happened, I think it was that summer, was in those nowadays the uniform allowance is that you get an account at the uniform supplier, and you just order uniform parts against your yearly allowance at the supplier. In those days, though, we got a check every year for our uniform. And, excuse me, and the amount of the check was based on, you know, what seasons you were working and how long you were working and whether you were seasonal or permanent and blah, 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 blah. Well, there was certainly no way I was going to spend that check on a uniform if I could get around it. I had other things that I wanted to spend it on. And so I was doing a nature walk from the visitor center out to the rim of the canyon. Got out to the rim, and my hat blew off. And it was the summer straw hat, flat hat, and blew over the rim.
Ooh.
And that was the most expensive part of the uniform. So it was kind of a disaster. And so after the after work that day, I went over and I peered over the rim, and I could kind of see it way down there below the Kaibab Cliff in the Toro Weep.
Ooh.
And
so a good couple hundred feet down.
Yeah, yeah, probably about 300 feet below the rim.
Okay.
And so that weekend, I kind of worked my way through the rest of the week without a hat. And then that weekend, I went down the Bright Angel Trail to Kolb Seep, and then contoured my way around on the slope of the Toro Weep down to below the Nature Trail. And it was really obnoxious. Those hats are just about the same shade of tan that the rocks falling off the Kaibab limestone are. So it took me quite a while, but I did eventually find my hat.
Wow.
And,
what kind of shape was it in?
Back over to the Bright Angel Trail and came up. And it was kind of interesting. It was, I was on the way back, I was driving a little clutch of mule deer ahead of me, and I could hear the tourists up on the rim. They were talking about the mule deer, but none of them ever talked about me. I don't know if it was because they didn't see me or what. And then below the El Tavar area, below the village area there, there was a fairly large, I guess you could call it a talus slope, of old soldered tin cans.
Hmm.
Where they just brought them out and pitched them over the rim.
Yep, dumped their trash right over the edge.
Yep.
Yeah. Did you find any other hats down there?
Actually, there were a bunch of ball caps that I saw. There were golf balls and frisbees.
And oh, my.
Funnily enough, the frisbees were all shattered. Apparently, by the time they'd fallen that far, they'd gotten up enough speed that they just demolished themselves on impact.
Oh my gosh.
So.
Yeah, that's an interesting route that is rarely traveled.
Yep, but I didn't have to buy another hat.
That's good. And your hat was in fairly decent shape having made the plunge.
Yeah, that was something that actually we the lore that we learned early on, those summer hats. The brim on them was really stiff, so they would stay flat. Mm. They just lacquered it up or something. And one of the things that we learned early on was to carefully go through and break the lacquer a little bit at a time.
Mm.
And as long as you were careful about it, you could make the brim flexible, but it would still be flat so that it wouldn't get all banged up, you know, when it blew off or when you walked into a wall or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So just one of those little tricks.
hat maintenance. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So you had mentioned that in the fall of 1981, you had done a couple of shuttles for the river unit that summer up to Lee's Ferry and down to Diamond Creek. And was this right at the end of your tour that you were offered to go on a river trip?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure exactly how it worked, whether I went along as a volunteer or whether I had checked out ahead of the trip or whatever, but it was literally the last days of my job at that season at Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And it was a lower half trip, so I went out to the Kaibab trailhead to hike down to meet the boats, and a friend gave me a lift out to the trailhead, and it was pitch black when I got to the trailhead, but I absolutely did not want to be late, so I'd gotten a real early start, like 4 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And I was headed down the trail with my flashlight, and realized pretty early on that I'd done the trail enough doing the Cedar Ridge hikes, guided ranger walks all summer, that I actually knew where all the water bars were, just like the mules do.
Oh, wow.
And I could, the starlight was enough to keep me oriented that I could walk down and not trip over the water bars.
Hmm.
And sun finally came up around Mormon Flat. And when the time came, I was waiting on the boat beach, and they exchanged. There were some people that had done the upper half who got off. I don't remember, you know, who it was. And then those of us who were doing the lower half got on. And it was, I'm sure I'd been in boats before, but certainly never been in a raft in whitewater before.
Okay, so this was a oar-powered trip?
Yeah, these were, if I remember right, we had one, maybe like a 16-foot Havasu and a couple of 18-foot Moravias.
Okay.
If that sounds right.
Okay.
But they were the Park Service patrol boats.
Okay.
And
was there anybody there in a kayak?
No.
Okay.
No kayaks. Just I think there were three boats.
Do you remember who was on the trip?
It was Kim Crumbo was the one in charge.
Okay.
And then I know that Ruthie Stoner now. I don't remember her last name at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But she was along. She was at that time. She was mostly the cook, but I know she did do some rowing. Well, in fact, we all did some rowing.
Okay.
And then we had a couple of patrol rangers who'd come down from the North Rim who were riding along on that trip as well. One of them was Len Dems.
How do you spell Len's last name?
D-E-M-S.
Okay.
Yeah, he went on, I think he went on to work in the regional office in Denver eventually.
Okay.
But we were going, continuing the river patrol that Kim was in charge of and going down to Diamond Creek.
Hmm.
So
okay.
So we climbed on the rafts there at the boat beach at Phantom and went through the Bright Angel Riffle. I had a death grip on the boat. Kind of like, this is terrible. I've never seen whitewater like this.
Okay. The Prior Riffle. The Bright Angel Riffle, yeah.
Yeah, and same death grip going through Pipe Creek, and then we came around the bend, and there was Horn Creek. It was just kind of like, oh my God, this is where it all ends. But
did you guys scout Horn Creek or just run it?
As I recall, Crumbo liked to scout everything.
Okay.
I don't remember for sure on every rapid, but I do remember having the impression that we pretty much scouted everything.
Okay.
So that day we ran horn, we ran granite, hermit, crystal. Ruthie got thrown out in crystal, so we had to fish her back out again. And then down through the gems, and then we camped that night at the upper Bass, the foot of the Bass Trail.
Okay.
And camped with a commercial group that night. In fact, we frequently shared, well, I shouldn't say frequently, but at least a few times we shared camps with the commercial groups. Excuse me. And that gave Kim a chance to go up and check out their, you know, check out whether they were following regs and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And then the second day we did hike up the North Bass, just kind of a patrol hike, hiked up the North Bass to just above where Bass had his camp there along Shinnamoo Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So we hiked up over the saddle down to Bass's camp, up Shinnamoo Creek a ways, and then came back down again. And then camped that night somewhere near Garnet, as I recall.
Okay.
And then the next day we went down to Elves, did a patrol at Elves, and I got up to the base of the Fourth Falls.
Okay.
Up there. So we scrambled up quite a bit, and that was when I discovered the difference between shower sandals and Tevas.
Ah.
Because Tevas were new at the time. I'd never even heard of them before. And all I knew was I was supposed to have, you know, I was supposed to have sandals for the trip. And
right.
So I'd gone to TGNY or whoever and bought some shower sandals, which really weren't the best. I made them work, but afterwards I went out and got myself some real sandals.
Okay.
So we did that patrol, went down stream. I think somewhere around Dubendorf that night, because we did, at least I remember we went up to the lower falls in Stone Creek.
Okay.
And then the next day we did a longer hiking patrol and went up to Thunder River, which really impressed me. You know, it was kind of a case of, yeah, the whole trip was just extraordinary. But as a single feature, I thought Thunder River was the most impressive single feature that we saw.
Nice.
And the whole trip I had, of course, at the time, this was kind of, oh, wow, this could be the only river trip I ever make in my life. And so I'd been reading up all about, you know, things to watch out for and all this kind of stuff. And had this great, and instead of the little river guides that fit in your ammo can,
mm-hmm.
I had this great big geologic guide that was waterproof. Although I did learn that when it got wet, you had to separate the pages before it dried out again. But I was trying to follow that as we went along and just having a grand time. We went down and stopped for lunch one day, probably the following day. But anyway, we stopped for lunch on the left just above Kanab. And we just finished up lunch, and it really started to rain. You know, just typically, this was in August, so, you know, typical monsoon downpour. And so we ran up under one of those big arched alcoves in the red wall that wasn't too far above where we'd stopped.
Wait a minute. I'm like, it's raining and you're going to run up into a big arched alcove.
Yep. Hmm. Yep. And so we're standing clear in the back of the alcove, nice and dry. And while we're there, all of a sudden there was a trickle of water coming down, you know, a couple hundred feet and splashing in the rocks way, way out in front of us. This was one of the deeper alcoves.
Hmm.
and, you know, trickling down, splashing on the rocks. And then all of a sudden, this torrent of red, muddy water shoots out right in front of our eyes, comes crashing down onto the rocks, maybe 100 feet out in front of us, and just, you know, explodes and brown foam down there and starts surging down for the river. So it was quite spectacular. You know, we were behind this big waterfall.
Wow.
And it was very cool. And then we noticed that as this flash flood then went down the tail of slope down to the river, it was going to hit the river right where we tied up the boats. So we'd stayed dry up to that point, but then we had to run down and, and move the boats so they wouldn't get washed out. So by the time all that excitement was done, why it was late enough that we just set up camp there that night. And as I recall, it was either that night was my birthday or the night before. And so Ruthie baked a pineapple upside down cake in the Dutch oven for my birthday cake.
Nice.
So headed on downstream from there and did a patrol hike at Havasu up to Beaver Falls and back.
That's a 10 mile up, 10 mile back. That's a long day. Oh, Beaver.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking Mooney.
I was going to say, I was thinking Beaver was more like six.
Yeah, but, not that far. Sorry about that.
But it was one of those that I discovered that, you can hike real fast. Of course, being August, it was also plenty warm. I remember the Thunder River hike. We got back from that and walked straight into the river. We were so hot. It was just, I know I need to cool off. And so everybody just went right straight into the river to get cooled down. So we did did Havasu, camped at National, and got some more rain at National. I remember throwing my ground cover over myself, my ground cloth over myself in the middle of the night to stay dry. And a bunch of the side streams had been flashing. And it's kind of like, oh, I wonder if Diamond Creek has flashed. And, of course, everybody was worried about being able to get out Diamond Creek. And it was kind of like, well, yeah, but I wouldn't mind going on half rations if we got to go all the way down to Pierce Ferry.
Yeah.
But didn't work out that way.
Hmm.
We were able to get out at Diamond Creek. And, of course, Lava Falls, that first time through, we definitely scouted lava and scouted it for a long time. And the more we stood there, the worse it looked. So that by the time we finally ran it, I was terrified. But made it through without mishap. I think the worst run we had was 217, and we'd all been taking turns rowing, and that was my first I have not since learned to read water any better than I learned on that first trip. They refer to it as Carl's Dog and Pony Show, because I'd take the oars and immediately the first eddy that we came to, I would get stuck in.
Oh dear.
So just go round and round. But 217, Len rode through, and he didn't get caught in an eddy, but he did manage to bounce us into the rocks at the head of it and then pull us back out so that we went kind of broadside through the biggest waves the rest of the way down. So it was an exciting ride. Nobody flipped or anything like that, but it was an exciting ride. And then got down to Diamond Creek, and that was my first takeout at Diamond Creek, and what a rude awakening, because of course August, there were a lot of commercial trips taken out at the same time, and lots of people, lots of commotion, lots of boom boxes going on. And after having spent several days, you know, coming downstream, it was kind of, no, I'm not ready for civilization.
Interesting.
So that was my first river trip.
Okay. What can you tell me about Kim Crumbo? That's spelled C-R-U-M-B-O.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I went down several times. I couldn't really tell you how many, but I did go down the river a number of times with Kim.
Okay.
And I was always real impressed. You know, he was kind of a reserved person with a real wry sense of humor. But he also just demonstrated a whole lot of care for the canyon. You know, we would each campsite and oftentimes at lunch and that kind of stuff, we'd be up doing micro trash patrols at the beaches. We'd be sifting charcoal where people had had illegal campfires, you know, fishing stuff out of the river. You know, he was always making notes on the conditions of the trails. You know, we did a lot of trail patrol and that sort of thing along the way. And for me, you know, it was pretty great to be able to go up and see all these different things along the way. But we were also working as we went, mm-hmm. you know, making cleaning stuff up and making sure that everything was in good shape and just evaluating the status of different things. So so he did demonstrate a lot of care and concern as well.
Nice. And Ruthie?
She was a lot of fun. As I recall on that trip, it was kind of her making me a birthday cake, and as I recall, I'm not positive, but as I recall, when she got tossed out of the boat in Crystal, she was actually laying on the back of the boat, just kind of stretched out there across the tube on the stern.
Okay.
And we hit a wave, and it just kind of dropped it, flipped it back up, and just flipped her right off into the river.
Bounced her out.
And she just completely took it all in stride. You know, she was swimming around in that ice-cold water, and was just, as I recall, laughing when we pulled her back in.
Nice. Well, that's fun.
Yep. So I got off, and you know, when I got off, it was still I had no idea that I'd ever run the river again, but it was pretty impressive. It was kind of like a whole new world seeing the canyon from that perspective.
Nice.
And that's one of the things that I would tell people. And still do, like when I do tours and that kind of stuff, tell people it's kind of like the old story of the blind men and the elephant, where the blind men are led up to an elephant. One of them takes the elephant's ear and says, "Oh, an elephant's like a fan." And another one grabs his tail and says, "Oh, no, he's like a rope." And they go through, and each one of them has this idea, and then they put it the fan and the rope and the snake and the tree trunks and all that kind of stuff. And they put it together and say, "Oh, that's what an elephant is like."
Hmm.
And Grand Canyon's kind of that way. You can see it from the rim. You can see it from the trails. You can see it from the river. You can see it from the air. And then once you put them all together, then you start to get a feel for what the Grand Canyon is.
Right. So this was the fall of 1981. Had you been applying for seasonal positions now? Because you're 180 days is going to run out.
Right, yeah. My 180 days ran out there, and since I'd started so early, it ran out there in August. And I didn't have a position. I'm trying to remember. I know that I did go back to work at Petrified Forest. And I can't remember if that was because I had applied to Petrified Forest as one of my winter parks or not. But I did go back to Petrified Forest.
In the fall of 81?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Went back, and it was the same, working in the entrance station, working in the visitor center. I had some little odd jobs. I kept working on some of the exhibits in the Rainbow Forest Museum, bringing them a little bit more up to date, and that sort of thing. I did have a VIP tour. At that time, Bruce Babbitt was governor of Arizona, and he and his family came up to kind of get away from Phoenix one weekend. And so I got assigned to tour him around.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun. He was a real nice guy, and it was definitely just out family fun sort of day. But we were going through the Rainbow Forest Museum, and he said, well, you know, in the Chinle Formation, the rock layer that the petrified logs are in, he says, they find these, you know, it's all this fine grain stuff, but periodically they'll find these big chunks of rock. And do you know where those came from? And I said, well, I don't know for sure, but I do remember reading something about that. The thought is that, yeah, the streams were just bringing in sand and silt, but when the logs floated in, they'd have rocks tangled up in their roots.
Oh, right.
And as the logs decayed, those rocks would fall out and get incorporated into the sediment. And he goes, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. And went on our merry way. I actually got a very nice inscription in my copy of his Grand Canyon Anthology book.
Oh, nice.
Thanks for a wonderful day spent in Petrified Forest, blah, blah, blah. Did a little more reading, though, later on, and I found out that I knew that he had a background in geology. And apparently his master's thesis was on the origin of these big rocks in the Chinle Formation.
Oh, interesting.
And where they may have come from. And I don't know if I scanned his thesis at one point or what, but I was certainly glad I'd given the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
And we were doing some other things as well. The 75th anniversary of Petrified Forest National Park was it was then. It was that year.
Okay.
And so there were some different commemorations and that kind of stuff. Every year the there was a, I guess you could call them horseman's club or whatever that did a Pony Express ride from Holbrook to Phoenix every year.
Oh.
And I wound up doing some artwork for that and designing the commemorative coin that they issued every year for their ride into Phoenix, because they were dedicating that year's ride to the 75th anniversary of Petrified Forest. So
cool.
So some, you know, odds and ends.
Hey, Carl.
They were kind of out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a gentleman named Sidney Ash.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about him?
Well, he, he came in and corrected my corrected my plant identification. And then several years later, starting about 1983 or thereabouts, Petrified Forest went through kind of a renaissance. And I was there for the beginning of it, and then there, and then I was at Grand Canyon. But I was in a subject of furlough position, so I was coming over to Petrified Forest. And we had lots of researchers that were coming into the park. Probably talk about more of that later when I get to my resource management job at Petrified Forest.
Okay.
But
if it's good to bring Sidney in later, let's just hold that thought and we'll do it then.
Okay. Why don't we do that?
Okay. Yeah. You'd mentioned him, and I was just like, oh, wait a minute, before we leave Petrified, I want to capture that. But if you're going to cover it, then let's hold on.
We won't leave Petrified until 1991.
Okay, so we've got some time.
got a long way to go yet.
And were you seasonal that whole time from year to year?
Well, therein lies a tale.
Okay.
I went back to Petrified Forest in 81 for that position, but there was this new guy in the White House right about that time named Ronald Reagan, who was talking about slashing the budget, reducing the federal workforce, and all this kind of stuff. And even though I'd gotten pretty good at coming up with jobs as a seasonal, I thought, you know, some of these seasonal jobs might start to disappear a little bit. And so maybe I should start looking into getting a permanent position. And so I did. That fall, I took the test. It was a written exam for the park aide position. So this was the park aide, park technician series. For a long time, if you went into a national park, there were rangers who had the higher graded positions, but a lot of the people who were working the entrance stations and the visitor center desk and that sort of thing were park aides, which were the lower graded positions, and park technicians, which were the medium graded positions.
Okay.
And it was in government, you know, personnel, position management, all that. It was a separate series from the park ranger position, even though we all did the same thing. And eventually, everybody in that park aide, park technician series was, or practically everybody, was converted to being a park ranger, but that didn't happen until several years later.
And so, what was the written exam like? What kind of questions would they ask you?
It was, I don't remember the test all that well, but as I recall, it was like one of those basic aptitude tests.
Okay.
I think there was some simple math and some reading comprehension and a little bit of logic. If A equals B and B equals C, does A equal C? And if A is part of B and C is part of B, are A and C the same? And, you know, just stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took the test. There were actually, at the south end of Petrified Forest, there were three of us that took the test, and none of us passed.
Really?
Yeah, we all failed it.
Huh.
And the park had actually been looking to hire all three of us.
Okay.
And so they demanded a recount or whatever they did in those days.
Let you take it again.
I don't think this was scored properly. We want you to take another look at these three
individuals. Oh, my gosh.
So they took a look at the three individuals, and two of the people were just dying to get on with the Park Service. And with me, it was kind of a, oh, well, if I get it, I get it, and if I don't, I don't. And I think what it was it wasn't so much failing as our scores weren't as high as they needed to be for the park to be able to hire us. So they reevaluated the three tests and decided that I had done better, but the other two hadn't. And they were so mad at me.
Oh, wow.
Not me personally, but mad, furious at the system and trying not to be mad at me.
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, in December of 81, I suddenly became permanent at a fair loss of pay. I had to go. I had been I'd worked my way up to a GS-5, and then I had to drop to a GS-3
Wow.
to get the permanent position. And but I figured, oh well, you know, I'll work my way back up again.
Right.
And so that's.
Was that,
what I commenced to do.
Was that normal that as a seasonal you might make more money than as a permanent? Or was it just for the job you were applying for?
It was was for the job I was applying for.
Okay.
And it was kind of a given when I first started trying to get into the Park Service in the mid 70s. You know, this was the whole Earth Day and all that kind of stuff. Everybody cared about the environment. And I remember sitting in an office at Grand Canyon, I think it was in 1973. And I'd applied to Grand Canyon that year. I didn't get any Park Service job that year. But I wrangled a quick interview with somebody in administration, one of the HR chief or whatever. And I remember sitting in his office, and basically the interview consisted of, well, have you considered applying for other positions and other land management agencies? We have like 100 applicants for every position that we fill here.
Wow.
And so especially in those days, the supposition was that you were going to have to take something really onerous to get in and then work your way out of that. And at the time, a lot of people were coming in as clerk typists in the San Francisco regional office at a pay scale that you couldn't afford to live San Francisco.
Hmm.
You couldn't afford to live in San Francisco on that kind of money.
Right.
Or you came in as a museum guide at the Westward Expansion Museum in the Arch in St. Louis.
But that got you into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, yeah, you're able
and
to move.
Once you were in, then yep. You could start wrangling your way up.
Right.
So I kind of figured, you know, okay, yeah, I'm taking a pay cut and I'm stuck in the entrance station at Petrified Forest again, but it could be worse.
Hmm. Yeah. And I would imagine that a number of people wouldn't want to be stuck in that kind of job very long, and they would quit or try to transfer out someplace else, and
right.
Then that position would be open again.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were kind of viewed as revolving door kind of positions.
Hmm.
Yeah, nobody's gonna like take this job and stay here forever.
Expect you to be there a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They would expect you to, as soon as your 90 days of, you know, initial probation or whatever was over, that you'd be sending out applications.
Hmm. Okay.
So.
Yeah, I just remember from my time at Grand Canyon, the entrance station was the place that was always hiring, and that would be a stepping stone to permanent status.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds mm-hmm. like Petrified was doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And pretty much everywhere, I think.
Okay.
So I did get my permanent job. I was there in the entrance station. One of the obnoxious things about the entrance station at the south end of Petrified Forest, it was the quieter of the two entrance stations. The other one was on Interstate 40, so it was a lot busier. But since we were the quiet entrance station, we were also the dispatcher for the park law enforcement.
Ah.
And so when we'd have dispatching duties, basically the entrance to the park would be closed while we were on the phone with DPS to run wanted checks or whatever.
Hmm.
And to make matters even worse, the entrance station was on a party line. So we'd pick up the phone and somebody else is on, and we'd have to tell them to get off the phone.
Oh, wow.
Because we'd have a law enforcement issue that we had to deal with. And we knew everybody else that was on the party line. And they knew it wasn't personally our fault, but they were pretty ticked at the park for not having a private line for that kind of work.
Yeah, because it's funny, you know, you think somebody wanted to, they could just listen in on the party line.
Oh, they absolutely could.
And, you know, listen to what was going on the law enforcement side of the world.
Yep, 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 they could.
Hmm.
So I was working in the entrance station. I was also periodically doing those remittances to the Federal Reserve Bank, working in the visitor center. I did a little bit of resource management type work.
Like
we were constantly scheming to get out of the entrance station.
Oh.
And okay. So I managed to tag in a little bit of resource management type stuff. I got certified to ride the park horses, so I could do backcountry patrols, which
oh, wow.
I didn't do often, but every now and then I could saddle up and spend the day out riding around.
How many horses did they have?
Two.
Okay.
Yeah, we had two horses, and one of them was kind of spirited, and the other one was, I don't know if he was really 40 years old, but he was just a gentle, plodding old horse. He did try to break for the barn at the end of the day, but we wouldn't let him do that.
Uh-huh.
The one thing he didn't like was wire.
Oh.
We surmised that he'd gotten himself tangled up in some wire in his youth or something like that. And I remember one day I was out riding, and just out in the middle of nowhere, I was patrolling the boundary. It was antelope season, and we had pronghorn in the park. And so I was just out riding along to see if the fence was broken or people coming into the park to try and poach our antelope. And he stumbled over a piece of wire, which scared him to death. He took off at a dead run. I managed to grab the saddle horn as I was disappearing over his rump and pull myself back up into the saddle, and finally got him slowed down and back to a walk and calmed him down. It was kind of one of those situations like when you fall off your bicycle. And the first thing you do is look around to see if anybody else saw you fall off your bicycle. That was me. The very first thing I did was started scanning around to see if anybody seemed to almost lose this horse. So, but I think the other reason we got to do horse patrol was pretty much in return for an occasional day out riding around. We would a few times a week we would have to be up there shoveling out the stalls, cleaning them out and everything in the morning.
Yeah, so, well, that's a fair trade-off.
Yep. So I was doing that. The 75th anniversary was still kind of going, and I wound up designing a float for the Fiesta Bowl for Holbrook that commemorated the park, and got to ride on the float, which was kind of fun, especially when when you're on a float in a parade, they anchor you to the float so you can't fall off. So I was standing there waving at the crowds, and then there was this vertical rod behind me with kind of a thing at my hips that was belted in under my shirt.
Wow.
So that I couldn't fall off the float.
Huh.
Unfortunately, this rod that I was that I was anchored to, it came loose from the float.
Ooh.
And so for the whole last half of the parade, it's moving around behind me there trying to wedge me off the float.
Oh, gee.
So I'm trying to smile and wave and keep from falling off the float. And I could hear people yelling, and look, that ranger's going to fall off the float. Like, oh, if only you knew.
Yeah, dear. Oh, my gosh.
So, let's see. I'm cheating here. I'm looking over my application for later jobs and looking and seeing what I did while I was doing this job.
That's fine.
But yeah, it was a case of I'd been working, trying to be useful as well as, you know, just my usual duties of answering questions and that kind of stuff. So I reviewed some publications for the cooperating association. I'd helped to put on basic wildland firefighter classes.
So after one season of fighting fire, now you're teaching classes.
I wasn't so much teaching classes as arranging for classes to be taught.
Oh, okay.
Although,
so you would arrange to bring in a specialist who would do the training.
Right. But it was a case of, you know, firefighting, especially at that time, and especially in northeastern Arizona where there aren't any forests. You know, firefighting was not as common among Park Service employees as it was among Forest Service employees.
Okay.
And so as a result, I did get to go out on a number of fires with Park Service. Don't think I ever went out on any wildland fires from Petrified Forest.
Okay.
But at various jobs from Grand Canyon, I would wind up.
Did you guys have any structural fires?
No, I did do training in structural firefighting, but the only structural, quote unquote, structural firefighting that I ever did was, I think it was in 1987. There was a train derailment east of the park.
Oh.
And so I went out and helped on that one. And that was as close to actual structural firefighting as I ever did.
Okay.
But I did. I probably over the years went out on 1, 2, 3, 4, probably 5 or 6 wildland fires.
Okay.
After I left the Forest Service.
Okay. But that was rare.
Yeah. And it was kind of, sometimes it was just a short stint. In 1981, when I was at Grand Canyon as a seasonal, I went to a couple of fires over on the North Rim. And one of them was just a one-day shot. It was over northeast of Point Sublime. It was one that we called the Excalibur Fire, and they flew a bunch of us in. Steve Pine was the fire boss on that one, and the fire was probably maybe an acre or so, and we dug line around it, and then the end of the day came, and we flew back out again, as I recall.
This is Steve Pine, P-I-N-E, who
P-Y-N-E.
P-Y-N-E, thank you, who would become a fire ecologist?
Right, yep.
Okay.
Yep.
What do you remember about him?
Yeah. What's that?
What do you remember about him?
Not all that much, because, just digging line.
Okay.
And he did save my life, because the end of the day came, and we were loading up the helicopter, and I went to walk around the back of the helicopter instead of the front to get to the other side. When he grabbed me and pulled me back. I don't know that I would have walked into the tail rotor, but I certainly wasn't thinking about it at the time.
Yeah.
And scary. Then the other fire that I was on the North Rim was one that it was, I think it was called the Imperial Fire. It was over by Point Imperial. But anyway, it was one where they called in a bunch of folks. We did a bunch of work on it. Then they released us all. And then after everybody was gone, the fire blew up, and the North Rim crew got stuck having to deal with it pretty much by themselves.
Wow.
And in fact, I think he talks about that particular fire in his Fire on the Rim book.
So in the winter of 81-82, then you would have gotten the permanent job.
Right. Right. And one of the big things that happened with that was it was a job that I knew I didn't want to have for a long time. This was my door into the Park Service, but I wanted to get through the door and move on. And prior to that, I'd always had these seasonal jobs, and I knew that no matter how bad the job was or my boss was or whatever, that at the end of 180 days, I was done. I could just, you know,
right.
I could leave it all behind and go on to something else. And now all of a sudden here I had a permanent job, and I was stuck in that permanent job until I could come up with another job or resign or whatever. But, you know, there wasn't an exit, a firmly affixed exit sign anywhere along the way for me.
I'm assuming you would have considered that, but I'm also assuming that, you know, before you took the job, that you wouldn't necessarily have known, had kind of put those pieces all together, or had you?
Yeah, it was, you know, you certainly knew it. You know, you took the permanent job because that's what you wanted. You didn't want, to put it bluntly, you didn't want to be fired easily when Ronald Reagan decided to slash the Park Service budget.
Right.
So you were looking for that sense of permanency. But then once you had it, then the mindset kind of changed and all these other things start to unfold.
Interesting.
Yeah, we kind of go, oh, yeah, what have I gotten myself into?
And so you did it for the next 10 years?
I was there from 81 until 83.
Oh, okay. I was thinking 91.
In that particular job. And what had happened was prior to getting the permanent job, you know, I had the potential to go back to work for the Forest Service on a fire crew, and then I also had obviously potential to go back to work for Petrified Forest, which I did, and Grand Canyon had fully planned on hiring me back the next summer as a seasonal. And of course I had to call up and tell them, well, I got a permanent job, so I won't be back. But at the same time, Jack O'Brien up at Grand Canyon, chief of interim, was working on converting some of the seasonal positions that they had at Grand Canyon into permanent positions. So I knew that Grand Canyon would be filling some permanent positions over the next few years. And I was staying in touch with folks up at Grand Canyon. My permanent position was a subject to furlough position, so that meant that I was off for 4 weeks without pay every year. That was my furlough. And I know at least in 82, I spent part of my furlough hiking in the Grand Canyon. So I was keeping in touch with what was going on up at Grand Canyon and applying for the jobs as they opened up. And so finally in 1983, let me take a quick look here. In 1983, I did get one of the positions up at Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And In interpretation. Went to that particular job was working in the Yavapai Geology Museum.
And did Jack hire you for that?
He did, although I don't. He was not my. He was not my direct supervisor.
Okay.
So my direct supervisor initially was Dale Schmidt, and then he, after a couple of years, he went, I think, over to the North Rim, and Susan Lamb was my supervisor.
Okay.
So it was right about the middle of the summer, I think.
In that time period from 91 to 9 to from 81 to 83, a couple of years there at Petrified. Anything ring a bell that was an interesting experience that happened during that time?
In that time, that's when we first started, a couple of things happened. One was I met my wife.
How did you meet? That's kind of important.
She was, she came on as a seasonal in 83, I think it was. Anyway, we met, it was just kind of a seasonal get-together, and we did a couple things together, and so our first date, I've since learned that I just thought I found somebody to share the gas money to go up to Flagstaff to see Return of the Jedi, but I later found out that was our first date.
I see.
Anyway, we did, she was working at the north end of the park, and I was working at the south end of the park, and so we'd run into each other occasionally, and we did some weekend trips together, and we went to Chaco Canyon, and that sort of thing. And then it was right about the time that that I moved up to Grand Canyon that I really got serious about this gal. So that worked out really well. Now we were suddenly 200 miles apart from each other.
Right.
And we're commuting back and forth on the weekends quite a bit.
And where this is Lori, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was Lori from?
She's from Wichita, Kansas.
Okay. How did she get a job working for the Park Service out of Petrified?
Well, she had, she was also part of that environmental generation.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually has a degree in park and recreation management.
Okay.
From Kansas State. And she had started out working on a YCC crew, supervising it, I believe, in Wichita, and then got a summer job up at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore in Wisconsin. The first summer she was there, she was working a YCC crew, and then she got a job as a ranger. She had a winter seasonal job at the Lincoln Home in Springfield, Illinois. I was like, one of the questions that they used to get was whether, after he was president, whether that was where Lincoln went to live. And she said, I never did really come up with a good way to answer that question. Eventually she says, I basically wound up doing something along the lines of, does the name John Wilkes Booth ring any bells?
Yeah, good, but, good. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
But anyway, then she had, she was between positions or whatever, seasonally, and was traveling around and checking to see, basically to keep her unemployment kosher.
Hmm.
Traveling around and stopping in at different parks to see if they had any jobs, and she stopped in at Petrified Forest, and they actually had a job.
Huh.
And picked her up, I believe, as a clerk typist initially.
Okay.
But then she wound up being a park technician, working at the north end of the park, and that's when we met, and then, like I said, when I transferred up to Grand Canyon, that was also right about the time that I started getting serious. I think she was serious before that.
Cool.
And doing a long distance dating.
Wow. Long distance romance. Yeah.
Yep.
And it's about 3-hour drive from Grand Canyon out to Petrified?
Not late at night, no.
How fast were you going?
Uh-huh. It would kind of depend. I pretty much knew where DPS hung out, so I could get over there. I think my best time was still like about 2.5 hours.
Oh, that's fast.
But there were there were times when you know, we would meet, agree to meet someplace else and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing that was kind of interesting at Petrified Forest before I launched off to Grand Canyon on that particular job was last time I was at Petrified, or the last few months I was at Petrified in 83, was when this renaissance in Petrified Forest research kind of took off.
Huh.
And I mentioned earlier Sidney Ash, who was a paleobotanist.
Okay.
And who had been working at Petrified Forest for years and years and years. But then there was another paleontologist. He was from the University of California out of Berkeley. And he was revisiting a bunch of the paleontological collecting localities that a UC Berkeley paleontologist named Charles Camp had been collecting in back in like the 1920s.
Hmm.
And some of them were in Petrified Forest. Well, the rocks of Petrified Forest, the Painted Desert Chinle Formation, is really, really soft. And so Rob Long was coming to see if he could locate some of these collecting localities from Camp's work some 60 years earlier, 50, 60 years earlier. And he would locate them, and lo and behold, a whole bunch more fossils had started eroding out.
Oh, wow.
And so he was finding, you know, all kinds of fossils out there, identifying some new species and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And so that kind of got things rolling in terms of, hey, there's work to be done out here.
Hmm.
And about the same time, the Petrified Forest Museum Association, the cooperating association for Petrified Forest, had been offered a collection of phytosaur teeth. And phytosaurs were they're only very distantly related to crocodiles, but they look like crocodiles. And they were inhabitants of the park 225 million years ago.
Okay.
And they had these long, sharp teeth. And this fellow in Holbrook had gone out and collected a bunch of phytosaur teeth and then mounted them in a frame, kind of like you see people do with arrowheads lots of times, you know, make pretty patterns with them and all this kind of stuff.
All right.
And he wanted to sell these framed phytosaur teeth with absolutely no paleontological provenance or anything like that. They were just teeth.
Wow.
Wanted to sell them to the park for this exorbitant amount of money. Well, the park didn't want to buy them. They kind of, no, this isn't paleontology.
Yeah.
We don't want a bunch of this stuff. And so they called up the regional office, and the regional office said, well, you know, yeah, we agree with you. This is not, from a scientific standpoint, this is not valuable at all. But why are you calling us? You know, you've got one of America's best vertebrate paleontologists, Ned Colbert, working over at the Museum of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff. Why don't you talk to him? And so Park called up Ned at MNA, and he came out and said, you know, this stuff is worthless, and huh. The park didn't buy it. But they also said, well, how come the museum has never come out and worked out here? You know, we're finding out that there's all this really neat stuff that's showing up in the backcountry. Well, come to find out, apparently years before, the Museum of Northern Arizona had worked at Petrified Forest, and then somebody in the park management decided that, no, the Park Service should be doing all this stuff, not MNA,
huh.
Told them to go away and don't bother us. We'll take care of the science.
Hmm.
And so that's what MNA did and had been doing ever since, long after whoever it was that told them to go away was gone. And so the park said, well, no, we'd be happy to have you guys back over here.
Oh.
And so we started having research happening in Petrified Forest that was significant. In fact, it's still going on today.
Cool.
And that was kind of just as I was leaving the park, all of this interesting paleontological research was starting to blossom over there.
Oh, my gosh. But you clearly wanted to move on to Grand Canyon.
Right. It was fun. I was getting to go out and do some work in the field with paleontologists. We had some archaeologists that were working there and that kind of stuff. But my main job was still there behind the visitor center desk or out in the entrance station box.
Okay.
And I had gotten a promotion. I think it was a GS5 at that point. So I had bumped up from my GS3 beginnings. It was kind of like, nope, I need to move on from this.
Hmm.
And that's not to say that as I was coming into Grand Canyon for the interim job that I'd taken, that I didn't have second thoughts. It was kind of like, okay, so now I'm going into an interim job, which is something else I've already done before.
Right.
Is this really the best move or not? But it was the move I'd made.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, I would imagine, petrified. You know, it's not like it has a huge variety of hiking options and doesn't have a lot of wildland fire.
No.
So a lot of things you were interested in that you'd been exposed to earlier at Grand Canyon certainly had some visitation, but not quite as much as Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it was, and I was not, at that point anyway, I was not situated to easily be able to move into a more challenging position.
Hmm.
The park staff was small enough that it's not like Grand Canyon where there's a whole division of resource management. At Petrified Forest, there was a resource manager, and he wasn't planning on leaving.
Okay. Okay.
and so you know it didn't have the organizationally it didn't have the opportunities that getting to a big park like Grand Canyon might have.
Right. Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, maybe this is a good point to wrap this part up, and we'll pick it up with your move up to Grand Canyon in 1983.
Okay. Yeah, let me take a quick look over my 171 here. See if there's anything else that I want to mention.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing really. My last few months of Petrified Forest, I was a supervisor, so that meant that I was bossing other people around.
Okay.
Which was important for my job applications to show that I'd been a supervisor, but really didn't amount to a whole lot. It was as much first among equals as anything.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, I think that's a good place to break off, and then when we come back and start in on my second job at Grand Canyon.
Okay. Well, with that, then, this will conclude part 5, oral history interview with Carl Bowman. Today is Friday the 13th, November 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Carl, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.